Hi, I'm Natalie. Today I thought we could look at the spooky dark history of Lake Lanier in the state of Georgia in the United States and look at where it gets its ominous reputation from and see why it's classed as Georgia's deadliest lake or one of, supposedly. So, with knowing that it has that terrible reputation, would you go swimming in a lake that has a history of murder, missing people, a racially charged violent history, lynching, rape, and hundreds of tragic deaths? Well, millions of people go swimming and visit that lake every year. So I guess we can judge for ourselves at the end of the video and see if there's somewhere that you would still be interested in going to as millions of other people still do. So, Lake Lanier itself is a man-made reservoir in the state of Georgia in the United States. And it was built back in the 1950s with the completion of the Beaufort Dam on the Chattahoochee River. It is also fed by the waters of the Chess. Oh, God, I feel like I'm going to say this wrong. Chestati River? Sorry, probably butchered that a bit, which was also created due to they needed like a sustainable water source for when there's droughts, a hydropower, and somewhere to put excess water in times of floods. And it also gives water to the Atlanta and surrounding areas. Lake Lanier was completed in 1956 and has an estimated death toll of over 700 deaths, with 200 of them occurring after 1994. So it is one of the deadliest bodies of water in the United States. But I feel like to really have a look at why the lake is so deadly is to have a look at the history of the lake and the history of the people that lived on the land before the lake even existed, because it is a man-made lake. So Lake Lanier is one of Georgia's largest lakes, with its shoreline 700 miles spread over 38,000 acres. Now that's a really big lake and it has a huge dark history to go alongside it. You might be wondering, where did they get all of that land from? Surely it wasn't already occupied, because that's a large area to take up. So Lake Lanier was originally planned to be built in Roswell, and I can't help but think of Roswell and think of the TV show Roswell. But it was later moved to Forsyth County in Georgia because the area was considered more rural at the time. So better space to take up some other people's land instead. To make way for the lake, over 20 cemeteries had to be unearthed and moved. And landowners with once thriving, fertile land with farms and everything and lives to be lived there were asked to sell their properties, and the town will be shut down, and they were asked to move by the government. Not to mention that it was once Native American land originally. So we first need to go back in time to the 1800s, when the first dark history of the land had started. And we need to look at the Cherokee and Creek Nation people, which were the indigenous people of that land. So the Cherokee people occupied the northwest portion of the state of Georgia, where Lake Lanier sits today. And it wasn't until the Trail of Tears in the 1800s, when the Cherokee people were completely removed from their homeland, and the history of the Native American people in the state of Georgia really took a really dark turn, and all of the Native American people were forced to move to a different state, a couple states over in Oklahoma, by force, or they were killed, which is just terrible. So before we talk fully about the Cherokee people, that were the native people of the land where Lake Lanier is, we need to also have a look at the Creek Nation people, who were also indigenous people of the land in the state of Georgia. So the Creek Nation people were targeted by the US government as they wanted their land. And the Creek Nation people were first to try and defend their land against the United States Army. And they fought in a battle against the US Army, but eventually were outnumbered and lost. So some of the Creek Nation people thought instead they could sell their land to the US Army and could just completely leave the state of Georgia and get away from everything and still walk away with some money. And the chief, William McIntosh, organized a treaty where their land was sold and they got money in return. So many treaties were actually signed over the years with more and more land getting taken by the US government. And then on the 12th of February, 1825, when the last of the Creeks land was sold in the final treaty of Indian Springs, Chief McIntosh sold the land for $200,000, giving the last Creek land in Georgia to the US government. The problem was that the Creek people didn't believe in selling their land as it was against their law and their belief system. As many generations had lived on that land before, it was their home to their ancestors. Many of the people were outraged and angry at McIntosh for his decisions on the behalf of everyone, and it went against the Creek law, and punishment for this action at the time was death. So historians believe that between 170 and 400 Creek Nation people marched to where McIntosh lived at the time to kill him as he betrayed his people. He came outside to face the angry mob that was there for him, and he didn't want to cower inside, met with gunfire and shot and stabbed by the Creeks as his punishment. The Creek people once were prosperous and now they were poor with no land or food and were sent into poverty. By the decisions of the US Army and William McIntosh, who betrayed his own people. So the Cherokee people, which I think were a bit higher up in the state of Georgia, saw what was happening to the Creeks and thought that if they learned from some of the mistakes of the US Army and how the US government were treating them, betrayed his own people. If they dressed like the white people and obeyed the white people's laws, then they could stay and they could keep their land and have money and food and everything like that. So the plan was them to assimilate with the white people and live alongside them. So in the state of Georgia, the capital of the Cherokee Nation people was called New Echota, which is still preserved today in a state park as a historical site. And on the map, it is just northwest of Atlanta, and the Cherokee people lived in Georgia in the northwest state. And you can see the building is still preserved in the New Echota of how the Cherokee people lived and how they assimilated with the white settlers. So they lived in like wooden cabins with a veranda, with beds and a fireplace, set their tables like the white settlers. Some even lived in a large homes who owned their own plantations and were very well off. They were the first Native Americans to have their own written language, and many of them could read and write. They even had a government building with a Supreme Court and had a written constitution that was based off the American Constitution at the time. They did all of this in the hopes of keeping their land and tribe together. So the US government didn't really want to help the Cherokee people. They really just wanted their land for gold and for farming. And unfortunately, in 1829, Benjamin Parks found gold on the Cherokee's land and really signaled the end for the Cherokee people there and the start of the gold rush. The removal of the Cherokee people began, and the state legislature introduced unjust laws that it would be illegal for Cherokee people to dig for gold on their own land. They could not testify against a white person and they could not assemble a council. They then divided up the Cherokee land and sold it in a lottery, just to white people, of course, and they were then forced to sign a new treaty of Echota, which I hope I'm saying that word correctly, in 1835, giving the rights up to their land. John Rich, a Cherokee leader, spoke against the removal of his people. He said that you forced us to follow your laws, form a Republican government, to cultivate the earth, to learn to read. We did all of this, but it still wasn't enough. And they were banished from Georgia in what we know today as the Trail of Tears. Some people left voluntarily, but those who stayed hoping that they could keep their land ended up in one of the darkest times in American history. In 1838, United States soldiers were sent to round up the Cherokee people who were still in the state of Georgia, move them across the Mississippi River to Indian Territory, today known as Oklahoma. General Winfield Scott was in command, and he basically threatened the people by saying that you have two options. We will take you to Oklahoma, where your people now live in prosperity, or I will slaughter you. The soldiers came and forced the Cherokee people to leave, not even allowing them time to grab their belongings or bring anything with them, only the clothes on their back. They were first held in these areas called stockades, which was basically like a concentration camp, then forced to make the treacherous journey across to the state of Oklahoma. Most of them traveled by land, but some took the river. It was a very long journey by foot, almost 1,000-mile journey to make it to Indian Territory. The journey was especially difficult for old and young people. If a baby died during the journey, the mother was not allowed to stop and bury her baby. She had to keep going. She could only bury her baby at night when they had stopped for the day. There are many reports of people hearing digging at nighttime for graves of people who died during the day. Due to the conditions, the walk taking months, it had gone into October where the snow had begun to fall. This insanely difficult walk just got even harder due to the snow. The terrain had turned to ice and snow. Most of the people's shoes, if they even had any shoe coverings, were mostly worn away by this point, leaving their feet to freeze and bleed, leaving bloody footprints along the way. Many people also died from exposure, starvation, no medical attention. Around 15,000 people started the journey and over 4,000 people died on the journey, taking over 4 months to complete. The Cherokee people called the move to Oklahoma Nundaunsani, meaning the trail of where they cried. Now the American Indians were completely moved off their land. The settlers sold their land to white people, like I mentioned earlier in those lotteries. And so the town could keep growing. And it was pretty easy for the white people to move in to where the Cherokee people were living because they had tried to assimilate into the white people's lifestyle. They had houses, food, stock, everything that they would need, and they could just move completely into their space and just live on their lives like the Cherokee people just never existed and just live in their houses, which is just awful and atrocious to think about what had actually happened to these Native American people. We'll move forward a little bit in time and we're going to look at a town called Oscarville, which was the last town to exist on the land of Lake Lanier before Lake Lanier was created. So Oscarville is a town that was formed in the late 1800s, and it was a thriving black community full of carpenters, blacksmiths, bricklayers, and farming in its top trade. So it was formed in the late 1800s during the Reconstruction of the era. Oscarville had been a thriving town for decades in Forsyth County. And there were nearly 1,100 black residents in the town, with 58 of them being landowners. And then as per the Digital Library of Georgia, 109 black residents paid farm tax, and meaning they rented or owned their own farms, while other residents were in craftsmen, trades, laborers, etc. So they were all vital parts of the community, and I felt like it sounded like they were more just treated as equals as they definitely should have been. The feeling of community was large in the town, and they were known for a lot of their churches. Pastors such as Grant Smith and Levi Greenlee Jr. were spiritual leaders and advocates for black residents. They helped bring the community together, and both black and white people. Records show organized picnics of churchgoers of both white and black residents together, collecting tithes, like when you take money to give to the church, from black and white residents. Tithes are 1/10 of an annual produce or earnings formerly taken as a tax for the support of the church and clergy. So not that much. Well, actually, I feel like it would have been a lot in those days, but you know, that's just the way it was back then. So Oscarville was a flourishing town. The records of 1908 Georgia school census show local funded schools, and that 316 children of color were enrolled in schools in Forsyth County. This wasn't a time of equality, and the white people of Forsyth County found the flourishing black community as a threat. You know, as you do, you can't just live your own life. You have to find someone that's a little bit different to you, a threat, apparently. So everything in Oscarville looked like it was going pretty well until the year of 1912. And unfortunately, that year brought on a racial cleansing of the land of all the black people that lived there. I feel like this was fueled by two main incidents that had occurred, two alleged assaults. The first was on September the 5th, 1912, when a 22-year-old Ellen Griss woke in her bed to find a black man supposedly trying to rape her. And by the 7th of September, Sheriff William Reed had arrested two black men. According to the Gainesville News, edition 12, 1912, and then according to some other websites like the Clio, apparently five men had been arrested in connection with the rape. And the people that were arrested were Isaiah Perkle, Johnny Bates, Tony Howell, Fate Chester, and Joe Rogers. Tony Howell was actually the one accused of the crime, but the other men were arrested and claimed that they were with him at the time of it happening. All men were put into the Cummingstown jail, and this spread throughout the black community, and the local pastor Grant Smith demanded that the men be released. Soon after this, Smith was beaten by an angry white mob, and they wanted to hang and burn Smith alive. I just wanted to clarify, because I don't feel like I explained it very well in this section, that the mob had turned on Reverend Grant Smith, and they actually started to brutally beat him as the mob was outside the jail, and he came there to talk them down, and they turned on him. And then Sheriff Reed and Deputy Gay Loomis had to intervene and shelter him inside the courthouse. Joseph McKay Brown sent the National Guard to prevent riots and transferred the men to multiple jails for safety. And then 2 days later, a white 18-year-old girl named May Crow was found injured after being raped in the woods less than a mile from her family's home. She unfortunately would later die from her wounds. Several black residents were, surprise, arrested and were named as suspects to the alleged rape and murder, but no substantial evidence was given. It was just speculation over who had done it. This included 16-year-old Ernest Knox, his cousin, 18-year-old Oscar Daniels, and 22-year-old Trussie Jane Daniel, and 24-year-old Robert Edwards. It's important to mention that Ernest Knox was coerced into a confession by a prominent Cumming resident who mocked and lynched him with a rope from a well nearby. In an effort to provide safety for Ernest Knox, he was transferred to a jail in Atlanta while the remaining suspects stayed in the jail at Cumming. Rumors were reported in the papers that the black residents threatened to dynamite the town if there were any more lynchings. Unfortunately for Robert Edwards, he had an angry mob on the way for him. On September the 10th, an angry lynch mob gathered around 2,000 people for one person, which is outrageous, outside the jail in Gainesville. The mob seized Robert Edwards with little to no proof of him committing the crime accused of. He was taken from the jail by the mob and brutally beaten and shot to death. He was then hung from a telegraph pole in the town square, where people took turns shooting him. He was only 24 years old when he died, which is just honestly, what the fuck? Not a single person was prosecuted for the lynching, and Edwards died without any evidence or due process. Then later in October, Ernest Knox and Daniel Oscar were both found guilty of rape and death of May Crow. An all-white jury took little over an hour to convict Knox and Daniel for Crow's killing. Trussie's Daniel charges were dismissed after she was given a deal to testify against Knox and Daniel, which is just terrible that they'd even put any of them in this situation when clearly none of them even did it because there's no proof at all. Apparently, public executions were illegal in the state of Georgia, and a tarp would have been put up to shield the hangings of the two boys, but it was burnt down the night before. Over 5,000 residents gathered to watch the hanging of 16-year-old Ernest Knox and 18-year-old Oscar Daniel. Again, there was little to no evidence, and the boys are still believed to be innocent to this day. This started a wave of violence towards the black community in Forsyth County. The mob threatened to the residents and fired shots in their houses. According to the Gainesville News and the Dahlonegger Nugget, the Night Riders, which were a white residents who came through the town at nighttime on horseback, burned down homes and threw explosives into nearby buildings of the black residents. This tirade on the black residents wouldn't stop until almost every single one of them had fled the town. They were forced to flee homes, properties, shops. They fled in all directions, but mostly fled to the whole county. Not all black residents fled, but the population of the colored people in Forsyth County was significantly low in the 1920s and 1930s, and they were forcing the black people out of their land and mass transferring ownership to white people. Part of the stolen lands were also sold to the US government in preparation for the land to be used for Lake Lanier. The tens and thousands of acres of land the government asked these people to give up was their home, where generations of families had lived. Putting a price tag on something that was virtually impossible, but they also had no other choice because the lake was coming and they had to leave. As the author of Underwater Ghost Town of North Georgia wrote in her book, at first the government assured landowners that they were being paid for the true value of their land and buildings. But residents found it was hard to price generations of memories, hard work and deep roots. Though some people refused to leave their land despite the generous payments offered by the government, I don't think they really got paid that well, to be honest. With some of the residents had to be physically removed by force by the US government. Over 700 families sold their land to the government, with a total of 56,000 acres ended up being acquired on the Chattahoochee River to form the lake. So the lands that were taken from the Native American people, then they were taken from the black people, and then from the white people in the end. Now we need to look at how the US government, after they stole the land from everyone, how they prepared the land. Because there was well-established generations of people living on the land, like there were cemeteries, there were historical sites from the antebellum period, if I pronounce that correctly, from 1812 to the start of the Civil War, 1861. The Civil War period, both colonialism and pre-colonial ancient times to the Native American people who originated on the land. Unfortunately, there were not all graves were moved, which is crazy, and the army corps of engineers moved marked graves, but due to capabilities of the time, the technological advances limited chances of identifying unmarked burial sites through subsurface scanning or other means, meaning not all graves were found and moved. So the Army Corps of Engineers anticipated that there was a chance of human remains to be found in the future of people that were just not recovered. So the next thing they had to do before they actually put all those billions of gallons of water on top was prepare the land for potential hazards in the future they could try and reduce when all that water was in. So they had to uproot trees. They deconstructed wooden buildings like barns that could float to the surface. They also demolished bridges and water intakes were relocated. Churches and cemeteries rehomed mostly, but not all structures were removed. Like the old auto racing track near Gainesville was left behind, and its bleachers were removed, though, as they were seen as a floating hazard. So the concrete block foundation where it was submerged, and when the water level gets really low, you can actually see pictures of it online and stuff. You can see parts of the submerged road and tires and some other old artifacts sometimes pop up. As the creation of the lake was so controversial, naming of the lake was also really difficult. So officials wanted to name the lake after Georgia politicians, and some of it wanted to be named after the legendary football coach. The lake in the end was named after Sidney Lanier, a 18th century Georgia poet who wrote Song of Chattahoochee. The land that can be seen today is the long lost peaks of the foothills, which are the peaks of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Georgia, which I thought was interesting and kind of like a spooky fact that the Blue Ridge, also called the Blue Ridge Mountains, are a segment of the Appalachian, however you say, for depending on where you're from, mountains in the US, which the Appalachian Mountains have a spooky history of their own with a lot of folklore about the Bell Witch, Bigfoot, the Brown Mountain Lights, the Flatwood Monster, the Moon-Eyed People, and the list goes on about all of the, you know, spooky tales and stuff to do with the Appalachian Mountains themselves are very supposedly like kind of haunted. I just thought it was an interesting connection between Lake Lanier and the Appalachian Mountains, as there's so many deaths happening in Lake Lanier and so many unexplained occurrences that happens in the Appalachian Mountains, really adding some extra spookiness to the story about Lake Lanier. So if we kind of rewind back to the start of the video, when I mentioned 700 people had died in the lake, 200 of them have had happened since 1994. 27 bodies are still missing. The people don't know where those people are, which is just crazy that many people have died in that body of water, which is kind of eerie to think about, and there's people still missing. And it's not like there's one area of the lake where all these instances are occurring. It's happening throughout the whole lake. So I feel like that's why people think the whole lake is haunted. And there are some like spooky ghost stories related to the lake too. A popular one that people, I think, is well known is the Lady of the Lake. So this is stemmed from in April 1958. Only a few years after the lake was built, 2 years after the bridge had been opened, is the story of Susie Roberts and Delilah May Parker Young. The two girls were driving down the Dawsonville Highway. One article said that they had sped out of a gas station without paying and headed to Dawsonville, and they were headed to the Three Gables Roadhouse. When Susie lost control of the car and she drove over the edge of the Lanier Bridge and plunged into the murky waters below. Where the car had plunged into the lake, there was around 90 feet deep of water underneath. And unfortunately, both girls were presumed dead from the distance and the impact into the water. So a year later, a fisherman found a body floating near the bridge, and it was believed to be one of the two girls that had gone missing. As the body had been in the lake for over a year now, it was almost impossible to tell which girl it was and was unidentified. The body was bloated, floating on the surface, missing two toes from the left foot, arms floating without the hands. This could have been from the trauma of the crash. Perhaps some of the lake's inhabitants, like catfish, had maybe eaten something on her. Local coroner's office tried to identify the remains, but it was nearly impossible due to the state of the remains and remained a mystery for the next 30 years. Many of the locals and visitors of the lake believe the remains to be Delilah May. Drivers on State Route 53 had seen her appear as a ghostly apparition. She had a blue dress on and was missing her hands. People who saw her said that she appeared to seem really like lost and searching for something. So it became a local legend of the area. And even after her remains were found, the sightings continued and the legend lives on. The Lady in the Lake is said to be a residual haunting where a traumatic event occurs in energy is heightened. The emotions are fused with the fabric of the place. So it's like recording a previous event that happened with an interactive entity. So in 1990, a construction crew were dredging the lake. They were preparing the area around the Lanier Bridge, Jerry D. Jackson Bridge, for expansion. During the dredging, the crew made the discovery of the 1950s Ford. And they actually found the remains of Susie Roberts still inside the car, which is just crazy. The car was half filled with mud, and it was said to be accumulating it over on the bottom of the lake for the last 30 years. Dental records confirmed the identity of Susie Roberts, and finally, both women could be laid to rest in marked graves. And it's still said today that Delilah can be seen on the bridge making her way to Dawnsville, appearing confused and lost, looking for something. And then a few years later, in 1964, on Christmas Day, two families piled into a car heading to an orchard to pick some apples. The Brown and the Rogers family both lived in Gainesville and were spending Christmas Day together. It was around 1 p.m. when the four adults, seven children, and the children range from 2 to 6, all piled into the car, and they were to drive across the lake on the 2 mile bridge on the highway 141 to get to the orchard. Unfortunately, they lost control of the car going across the bridge and clipped a guardrail, then a power pole, splitting it into two and flipped into Lake Lanier below the bridge. Many people witnessed the incident and jumped to their rescue, but the car sank to the bottom of the murky, ice-cold water. And it was so dark, it was like basically impossible to see them and to help the 11 of them just because of the conditions of the water itself. And they thought the car probably sank below 30 feet below the surface. So there was a lot of speculation that Mr. Brown, who was driving the car, had been drinking and had a lot of liquor in the morning before leaving to go to the orchard at 1 o'clock and was driving really fast. Emergency services managed to find the car, but unfortunately, 7 out of the 11 died, 5 children and 2 adults, including the driver himself. Amazingly, 4 people survived the awful crash, which I don't even know how that's possible. And there was also been tales of when families go camping there with their children, the child at night will hear someone calling out to them from the water, and then the parent will go find their child sleepwalking towards the lake. Most of the children have a similar tale about someone calling out to them from the water's edge of the lake, almost trying to pull them towards the water. And there are many unexplained occurrences on the lake. There have been over 500 boating accidents. Some of them have had the boat unexpectedly go up in flames. One man is a local, Buck, Bekenna said you can reach out into the dark and you can feel an arm or leg and it doesn't move. That's creepy, which is quite an ominous statement to have on record, I feel like. And the lake itself is like super dangerous for boating and swimmers because like there's the currents are changing, there's always changing in depth really rapidly. It's super dark and murky, and then there's also like concealed objects under the water, making it hard to see. And then because the water level is affected by droughts, making it even more dangerous for boaters because then they become closer to these submerged objects. So throughout like different droughts over the years, some of the submerged objects have been more visible through like the top of the water. And like the lake floor itself is filled with debris from ferry boats that have crashed, cars, bodies, trees, forests-like areas that still remain, remnants of ghosts, town-like buildings, cemeteries, and the list goes on. So like there's still like whole buildings underneath the water and everything. So in 2007, there was a particularly bad drought that year that brought the water level down so low that you could see the old race car track. You could see cars, boats, buildings, all other debris that had been like resurfaced during the drought. The water level was also so low around some people's houses and their jetties that there wasn't any water under the jetty for people's boats. They had found some missing people, so some bodies apparently had resurfaced with the water level going down so low. So it kind of makes you think like what else is hiding underneath the water level there if it goes down even lower in the future. So when the water level goes down, it brings all of those hazardous objects close to swimmers and boaters. And the water depths are so unpredictable due to the remnants of the foothills. The one moment you could be shoulder deep in water and then you take a step forward and then you've gone 30 feet drop off below you. So you really need to almost be like more of an experienced swimmer if you're going to go swimming in Lake Linear in some of those sorts of areas, I feel. Divers today also explore what remains of the underwater ghost town buildings and structures that can be explored but at your own risk because it can be hazardous and the visibility down there is so poor. There is footage of trees, buildings, even signposts, old tombstones that pop up through the water when the water recedes and also from the divers that go down below into the depths. So unfortunately, there can't seem to be a year that goes past on Lake Linear without a tragic death occurring. Last year in 2023, for instance, in July, there were couple of deaths that happened in quite close proximity. The first death was a 24-year-old who was electrocuted on July 27th, 2023, jumping off a dock into Lake Linear. He was jumping off his family dock into the water near Lake Linear Beach, close to the South Ride Road in Forsyth County. It said he went into the water and then a short time later started yelling. There was electricity coming from a nearby power box into the water. A neighbor shut off the power and they got him out of the water, but unfortunately he died later in hospital. The next instance that occurred quite close by to that was on the 29th of July, 2023, a 27-year-old male went into the water, but he never resurfaced. He was a boat mechanic and was swimming at Vanpool Park, sorry, I might be saying that wrong. He disappeared. Law enforcement and his family are still searching for him. Also another one on the 29th of July last year, a 61-year-old was swimming near East Bank Park and unfortunately never resurfaced. After searching the area and using sonar technology, they made the sad discovery of her body found 46 feet deep underneath the surface. Also, a 21-year-old man jumped into the water in April last year with some friends and none of them had life jackets on and started to struggle to stay afloat. A passerby on a boat came over to help three of them in their distress, but unfortunately a 21-year-old went under and could not be found anywhere. Due to the limited resources of the Georgia DNR and the Hall County dive team, they turned to a private search team instead. They pieced together the group's last movements on the water, and with the help of the private search team, a non-profit team managed to find his body 86 days after he had gone missing. Even in the designated swim zones on Lake Lanier, people have still drowned, and they've had to use sonar technology to find their bodies because the water is so dark and treacherous. Okay, well, thanks for joining me on my video about Lake Lanier. I definitely really enjoyed learning about all the weird things that happen in Lake Lanier, strange occurrences, and the history about the land of Lake Lanier. I definitely think it'd be interesting to find out some more stories about other spooky lakes and maybe even some other fun true crime stories or crazy Reddit stories. If I find any of those, I will make some more videos on them, and hopefully you enjoyed this one. And I don't know if I'll go swimming in Lake Lanier. Let me know, would you go swimming in Lake Lanier after finding out all of those weird facts about Lake Lanier? I mean, potentially, because like you only live once, but yeah, all those people that go there every year, be careful, maybe wear a life jacket if you're on a boat, and maybe don't drink so much if you're going to drive the boat around and swim, you know, because there seems to be a high amount of numbers and stats coming out every year from that lake. So have fun, and hopefully I'll see you in the next video.